I want to jump up and down and dance and scream. This is a dream come true. I have four wonderful words for you. Podcast of the year. I'm Namulanta Kombo, and yes, my show has won top prize in the British Podcast Awards. Dear Daughter is Podcast of the Year 2022. So, if you aren't already a regular Dear Daughter listener and want to know more about what all the fuss is about, you know what to do. Search for Dear Daughter from the BBC World Service wherever you found this podcast. The whole of season one is available to binge now. Go on, listen to the podcast of the year.
People fixing the world.
Welcome to People Fixing the World from the BBC World Service with me, Myra Anubi. This is a solutions program that finds people who are trying to make the world a better place. Today, we're meeting individuals who are finding clever ways to provide emergency shelter for refugees and displaced people. In May this year, the planet reached a grim milestone. For the very first time, the UN recorded more than 100 million displaced people. That's 100 million people forced out of their homes because of issues like war, persecution, or natural disasters. Now, many of them end up living in tents, and I'm not talking about months here, I'm talking about years. Imagine that you're recovering from a traumatic experience and then you don't know when or whether you'll be able to go back home. Now, imagine having to live in that situation for several years with very little space and no privacy.
So we had to live in tents. Tents made of fabric are so difficult to live in. During winter, you get soaked in water and you freeze. During hot weather, you burn. It is such a difficult life. They were literally just random tents made of fabric.
But there are projects around the world that are doing their best to provide alternatives other than just tents for people who need refuge. Farhana Haider has been finding out more about this. And to start with, she visited this interesting project in Sweden that's providing temporary homes to displaced families.
I'm in an idyllic location, a field in the Swedish countryside. Behind me are trees, but what's unusual is in front of me, a small white building is going up. But that's because I'm here with the team from Better Shelter, and they've been designing homes for displaced people since 2010. They're about the size of a caravan, 17 and a half square metres. But what's striking about all of these shelters is that they all started out in a cardboard box. Like these. Because they are flat pack homes for refugees, inspired by one of Sweden's famous exports, IKEA flat pack furniture. And Johan Carlson is the man behind it, and he's with me now. Johan, what's the idea?
The idea is to provide a safe and dignified shelter quickly in emergency response. So it can work just as quickly as a tent, but with a big difference that it can last much longer and provide significantly more safety and security.
And why is it needed? Why do we need flat pack shelters for displaced people?
Well, I think this is really like the last resort where you have nothing else to go to. Then you need to fly in temporary shelter solutions. Traditionally, that has been tents. So what we are doing is that instead of a tent, we are having a temporary shelter that is robust enough to last, over years and to be upgraded. In order to achieve this, we need to have them, flat packed for efficient distribution and also to be cost effective.
And Johan, how many of these shelters have you built and where are they in the world?
Yeah, we have it's more than 70,000 shelters right now that we have distributed to almost 80 countries.
So how many components are there all together in these two boxes?
Let's say there are around 80 or so different articles. It requires some patience to get it together, but it works very fine.
So I've had a look through the manual that comes with the two boxes, Johan. Yeah. And you know, they're all illustrated and they look very familiar. It does look like an IKEA manual in many ways.
Yeah.
And strained relationships that other IKEA furniture tends to do when you're setting that up.
It is. I think that putting up this shelter, I would say it's a good test of your relationship. There's some patience required, you know, you have to fiddle with some details to get it right. And, you know, and typically you tend to have one or two people have different opinions on how you should build it. So
we're about 2 hours into the process. So Anthony here is from the Better Shelter team. And Anthony, what are you doing now? You've got a panel. It's made of foam, is that right?
Yes, it is like a special foam that we make, treated with fire retardant, so for safety and fire safety reasons. I am now putting a window on. First, I will fasten the window to the panel. Then I will add the mosquito net. And the window is made on this size. Many have said that they wanted it bigger, but for safety reasons, for protection reasons, so not allowing people to enter from the window. So it has to be this size to protect the people inside.
So it's far smaller than a standard window. How big is it? It's about 30 by 40 centimetres?
Yeah, around that. One done and three more to go.
So, that technique. And Marta here is also from the Better Shelter team. You're putting the spokes in, the roof has just gone up.
Yes, so we're adding extra pipes to the frame, which will make the foundation and the framework even more stable. And right after this, we will be adding wires as well to make it even more stable and very wind safe.
Marta, I'll let you get on and finish building this shelter.
Thank you.
So Johan, the inside of the shelter has been built. Can you show me what the features are?
Absolutely. Please step in. So first we are entering through the door. And what we see is a rectangular sized room, you know, 17.5 square meters. So it's not like a very big space. This is where you're going to stay for years. So in order to improve your privacy, we have a room divider in the middle. So you can divide this room into two rooms. We have a lamp so that it can keep light at night. You can also charge your cell phones here, which is increasingly important for people. We have four windows so you can get some air and light in. Four ventilation openings, and that's it. So I think it's a very basic, you know, structure that we are having, but it's a big difference from, you know, a tented solution, you can imagine, particularly if you're going to stay in here for years.
So as you say, it's quite a basic structure and the room looks very bare. Yeah. So you've got the curtains, as you describe, the floor is covered with tarpaulin, and there's the curtains. Do you think it's important that people are able to personalise these spaces?
It's utmost importance. And we have seen it, and it's very interesting to see that once people are moving inside, they start decorating the shelter. So that need is just as real as the need is, you know, to keep the rain out, to keep safe, you know, from the wind.
Yes, so we've just attached the lock to the door. We'll close the door now and consider it done.
Good job done.
Yes.
Done. Locked. And how long did that take?
About 4 hours, I think.
Well, well done, both of you, on a very, very hot day.
Yeah.
You finished it?
We did.
I'll let you go and lie down now.
Thank you.
Farhana joins me now in studio. And before we start, you know, finding out more about this, Farhana, how hot was it exactly?
Hi, Myra. It was very, very hot. Mm. Exceptionally hot. Record temperatures, in fact, for Sweden. But actually, the team said it worked out quite well because the majority of displaced people live in the global south, which is where a lot of these shelters will be heading. Mm-hmm. And so they have to set these shelters up in extremely high temperatures.
Mm. And how many people does it take to put up one of these shelters?
Well, the Better Shelter team recommend 4 people. So you need people to hold up the roof and put it down and set it on the frame. But any more than that, and they say too many people, too many opinions.
So Farhana, I'm here and I'm thinking this sounds like a great solution, but I'm also thinking about the people who have to live in these shelters. I mean, what did they think about them?
Well, that is the question, Myra. So I think we need to hear from some experts on this topic. Mm. And by that, I mean, of course, the displaced people themselves. I was able to make connection with Wala, who you heard there at the beginning of the programme. Mm-hmm. So she's been displaced in Syria since the civil war began in 2011 and now lives in a camp for displaced people in Idlib.
It is a feeling you simply cannot describe. When you leave your belongings behind, the place where you grew up, the house you loved and lived in, to leave all of that for reasons beyond your control and power, it is a very difficult feeling.
This is Wala, and like most of the 100 million people displaced across the world, she is internally displaced after she fled her hometown of Homs when the Syrian civil war broke out in 2011. She fled first to Damascus, and then when that was no longer safe, she went to a town near the Iraqi border, eventually arriving in Idlib. It was here that she lived in a tent in a camp.
I lived in the makeshift tents for about a year and 9 months. It was very tragic. It's just fabric, like the clothes you're wearing. How can they protect you from heat or cold? It was also 2 meters long, sometimes even shorter than a human. So we could not even stand up. It was more awful than you can ever imagine.
Wala now lives in Kafr Jalis IDP camp, run by the Maram Foundation, a non-profit that has provided assistance to internally displaced people since the beginning of the Syrian crisis. Wala lives in a better shelter temporary home, which she refers to as a caravan. She lives here with her 3 children, aged 10, 8 and 7, her husband and her mother-in-law.
I've been living here for about 8 to 9 months, but life is completely different. It is like a campsite with caravans. We don't live inside pieces of fabric anymore. It protects you from rain and sun. It is not like a random piece of fabric that soaks you in water or gets ripped away because of how strong the sun is. We even used to have holes in the fabric. This protects you from hot and cold weather. Back there, you used to have insects going into your tent. This is different. It is contained.
On a video call, I asked Wala to show me around her home. She shows me that the family live in 2 better shelter homes, which they have connected. The family live in one and her mother-in-law in another. They've also built a separate kitchen and a bathroom. On the floor are rugs, and a colourful curtain is also up, behind which she stores the family's clothes and other items. I was also introduced to one of her daughters, Lana.
Lana, khijlet Lana.
Wala is clearly proud of her home and what they've managed to create.
The whole caravan feels like a room. It doesn't feel like a tent or anything. It's got proper, steady flooring, unlike the previous tent where the floor was full of pebbles and sand and water, or moisture even. This is just like a proper house.
Wala would like to return to Homs one day, but doesn't remain hopeful. For now, she feels safe in the camp, and the better shelter temporary housing, which they've managed to make, feel like home.
Since I already lived here for 9 months, I can continue living here for 9 years. You adapt to one day, you can do a year. Nobody knows when the revolution is gonna end.
Farhana, it's really good to hear that she's happy with the place, but then she's also saying that she's prepared to live there for 9 years.
Yes, she is, Myra. These homes are meant to be temporary shelters, but sometimes people live in them for many, many years, as many as 20.
So something's missing here, Farhana, because these are not meant to be permanent shelters.
You're right, Myra. I mean, what should be happening is they should be planning over multiple years and laying down infrastructure that will produce decent homes. But from a political position, that's impossible. And so nothing permanent can be built in these camps. You have to be able to take these shelters down. It's a barrier that stops better solutions in many cases.
Right. And I mean, speaking about problems, let's talk about cost for a second, because I'm sure that these shelters cost more than the tents that have been used.
You're not wrong. These shelters cost about 3 times more than a tent. A tent is about $400. These shelters cost about $1,500.
That's expensive. I mean, I know they've set up, 70,000 in more than 80 countries, but we're talking about millions of displaced people.
Yes, Myra, and these numbers will just go up. According to the UN, 100 million people are displaced currently. but they're also estimating that that number will double by 2050. But the allocated budgets are staying flat. So actually, they're just too expensive, and that is a real problem. But it is one that Better Shelter are looking at. So when I was with the team in Sweden, they were also trying out a number of prototypes. These were really a lot simpler versions of their current shelters. So Mari, they are keeping the same frame, okay. So the height and shape remains the same, but they're using different coverings. So the one that I saw, they were using tarpaulin, that's water-resistant canvas.
Doesn't this just sound like they're going back to the original tents, the basics, really?
You're right, Myra. And that's the point I put to David, who's head of product design at Better Shelter.
Of current shelter, it's a paneling material. It's a sort of sandwich material. This is standard humanitarian tarpaulin that we're using for the prototype. It may or may not be this material, but we're trying different solutions and then we can select whatever. And currently we're just pointing out our favorite bits and pieces.
So if we move into one of these shelters, first thing I noticed, David, is it's far taller than me and it's far taller than you, and you are a lot taller than me. So the height and the shape seems very much like the shelter being built by Johan and his team. And for a tent, it's big.
Yes, it is. So the footprint is sort of a standard humanitarian response size, but the height is substantially higher than most tents. And it does provide, my feeling is walking into it, it feels more like walking into a sort of sturdier structure than having to sort of bow your head walking into to a lower pitched tent. But in terms of maintaining safety and dignity, we do believe that has a great benefit. It could also work in a benefit in terms of thermal comfort. We can get the hot air to rise and be able to ventilate it out, more air volume, etc., etc. So there's other benefits to the height of it as well.
It's a far simpler design. Why are you simplifying?
Because we're looking at sort of trying to respond to the needs of the humanitarian sector, and our current version lacks a bit of speed and also cost. It's a bit too expensive. So we're trying to facilitate something that could work in an emergency, easily put up, low cost, but still utilizing our load-bearing frame, and then it could upgrade it over time.
This is People Fixing the World from the BBC World Service. Today we're talking about how to get displaced people out of tents and into better living conditions, a challenge for millions of people from all across the world. Now, we've just heard about Better Shelter that's giving temporary homes to these families. But Farhana, there are many other smart ideas that people are trying to do to help as well.
Yes, Mari, you're right. And one of them has been designed by Gizu and Morgan Hariri. They're architects based in New York, but they're originally from Iran. So Gizu told me about how the sisters' design is rooted in their own experience of losing a home during the Iranian Revolution in 1979.
In 1979, we had to make a decision where we wanted to make our home, because our intention obviously was to go back to Iran and make it a much more modern and progressive country, which, you know, had started to become. I mean, the fact that, you know, two sisters and two women came to United States to study is a testament to how forward thinking the country had become. When we saw and observed what was happening, human rights issues, women, oppression. So the choice was, okay, you know, if you don't go back to your own home, where do you make a home? And it has been this search for a home, a safe and, you know, sacred place to live in with integrity and peace that has basically become the essential quality and philosophy of all our architectural work. And I believe unless you experience a tragedy of losing a home, you don't understand, I think, the spiritual value of a home.
So Gizu, tell me about the design of your emergency shelter and describe it for me.
So the folding pod, it's a prefabricated modular folding structure that was inspired by origami, the Japanese art of paper folding. It's a compact exterior, but it has a chiseled geometrical form to it. It's not a box. It's not like your regular prototypes that you see around. These are fully made structures, and with just a solar power generator, you know, you push a button and they open up. I mean, we are making them with recyclable carbon fiber, which is very safe, very strong, very durable. It would be easy to transport because once it's flat, you don't need construction crew. You can put it in any airplane. You can put it in, you know, shipping containers. These pods, even though they are designed to work as a temporary structure, they could also be expanded with additional other pod units into a variety of habitable combinations.
So what stage are you at, and what are the problems that you've been encountering?
Our basic problem has been funding from the beginning. So the concept model proved that it's viable, it's doable, and it actually works. I think we need just basically a visionary government or agencies with less bureaucracies. I think gazillionaires who have a lot of money can step in and help. Some of the United Nations humanitarian agencies only are interested in the product. They want to see it completed. They want to see it finished. And then they would guide us to go to another agency to get probably an order for so many of them. But, you know, we are not there at the moment because we are doing our pre-production prototype. It's going to be a very slow process, but I am 100% sure that we can complete it.
One of the things that has struck me about this, Farhana, is that they're using recyclable carbon fiber.
Yes, Mara, they are focusing on sustainability. It's a big part of their design, but it also makes it expensive in terms of emergency housing. One unit currently costs about $7,500.
That's really expensive. How practical is this when you're talking about emergency shelters?
You're right, it isn't. Certainly not in terms of emergency shelters. They need to reduce the costs in order for it to be used in an emergency setting.
And do they have a plan to do this?
Well, Mara, that is what they're working on at the moment. They're also looking for investors. And once they are in a position to mass produce, the sisters say the cost will come down significantly.
It's a shame because aside from cost, you can tell that bureaucracy is also standing in the way of this project picking up faster than it would.
Yes, I mean, these UN bodies tend to be quite bureaucratic. The organisation is very big and the politics can be challenging to navigate. People don't always want to acknowledge that these camps might be there for years and years, but Better Shelter have managed to get their design off the ground.
So what did they do differently?
Well, Mara, they say it's because their designs are cheaper and practical, but they've also got serious backing from a big multinational, IKEA, which helps. And Better Shelter actually very open about that, how having the IKEA Foundation as a supporter has helped them. It's a well-known brand, and they also have the money to invest in design.
The last idea we're going to look at today is trying to solve this issue from a different angle altogether. So far, we've been looking at pre-built solutions to the housing needs of displaced people. But there's a separate movement within architectural and humanitarian circles. They're of the opinion that we should be using local building techniques and products, and even getting displaced people themselves involved in the process of making these homes. We're going to hear from the guru of Pakistani architects, Yasmeen Lahri. She's 81 years old and she spent years trying to improve shelters for displaced people in her country.
My name is architect Yasmeen Lahri and I'm chair and chief executive of Heritage Foundation of Pakistan. My favorite title for myself that was given to me by Politecnico di Milano is architect for the poorest of the poor. In 2005, Pakistan was hit with a massive earthquake.
Whole towns have been obliterated across India, Pakistan, and Afghanistan. Schools have collapsed, killing hundreds.
Like everybody else, I just wanted to go there to help. I had no idea. I'd never done any humanitarian work before. And so I just arrived on the scene. And really, you know, it's a heartrending scene. I don't know whether anybody who's seen that kind of a disaster, you can never forget it. 80,000 lives were lost and something like 400,000 families were displaced. And so I decided to start and I did not know whether I could do something. I thought we could start helping them to build their houses from the debris.
70-year-old Noor Ahmed doesn't have the money to move his family down from the mountain. He scrapes through the ruins of his home for building material. A shelter of corn stalks is all he has to cover his bed.
And we managed to build quite a few, actually, houses at that time. And I thought I'd go there for maybe a couple of months, but I'm afraid after, I don't know, 16 years, I'm still in the same game. So then it turned out that we were building things which were one-fifth the cost of normal construction of all these other big-shot INGOs or UN organizations. And so we managed to do a huge training program for people and build with mud and lime and bamboo roofs, because nobody could believe bamboo roofs would last. And we built about 40,000. You know what I found in disasters? Everybody is at a very low ebb, and we need to find ways for them to get engaged in something that they will find productive and will look forward to. That's one kind of therapy that they need also, to know that they have a part to play in making whatever they are making. And so we decided to teach people how they could do the building themselves, right? Starting from how to mix, how to test the earth and mix the earth, how to use lime, because lime is something that people are not familiar with. And then again, cutting bamboo, putting it together. So we started to make these videos, and I think we've turned out with about, now there are about 24 of them.
It's necessary that when these panels are placed on the plinth or chowki, they will be standing in the same way.
I see the IKEA Better Shelter, and I think it's a good thing that prefabricated stuff can be sent out and people can put it together and they use it, because the need is of immediate shelter. But of course, to me, the cost is high. But then this is the whole problem with working in the West, is that every cost is high. The materials are sourced somewhere else. And so that means that the local economy does not benefit from it. I would go for something that could be permanent, that doesn't have to be redone all the time, that is allows people to be innovative themselves. I mean, my philosophy is a little different from, obviously, from IKEA philosophy, but then I am from the Global South. And maybe IKEA should be looking at this to see whether they can use bamboo. I mean, they are right now using steel, and I believe. And if they were to use bamboo, maybe they can come up with a good solution. I think it's a good idea to now be looking at alternative materials.
This is interesting, Farhana. I mean, there's a new idea here, and it makes sense, involving the displaced people in building these homes.
Absolutely, Myra. And Yasmin is looking at the problem from a different perspective. She's put displaced people central to the process. She feels that they know best about what will work for them. Mm-hmm. It also allows shelters to be personalised. So if you look at some of the images of these shelters, they look very beautiful. They can be painted on, so they can look individual. Mm. Whereas tents and better shelter housing all look very much the same.
Right. And then, of course, they're using bamboo, the local materials.
Yes, she's using locally sourced material, material that's available in the country the displaced people are in. And it's something that Better Shelter have said they want to do more of, use material in their design that's locally sourced. In India, for example, they've been using bamboo to cover their frames and are hoping to do more of that in their new designs.
Mm. And of course, potentially, this could also reduce the cost of building these emergency shelters.
Yes, absolutely. They could help cut costs and make building easier. So less need to ship material around the world.
Right. I mean, we're looking forward to seeing what happens with this. But thanks, Farhana, for what we've heard today.
Thank you, Myra.
Now, there are many people and projects that are trying to offer help to families that have been displaced. So there might just be a solution at your doorstep that could work for this or any other global issues. If so, go ahead and send us an email with your name and location to peoplefixingtheworld@bbc.co.uk. You can also listen to our previous episodes wherever you get your podcasts. All you need to do is search for People Fixing the World. I'll be back next week with more great solutions. But until then, thanks for listening.
I was trying to understand why my friend from school time and other friends from our city were becoming jihadis. She was in Syria.
6 months pregnant, you travelled to Syria in order to make a film about this friend of yours.
Just a personal documentary about her radicalization.
This is Lives Less Ordinary. Remarkable personal stories from across the globe.
She was part of a group which was connected to Al-Qaeda. I was not feeling insecure because I had a security guarantee from my friend and the group she was associated with.
Lives Less Ordinary, from the BBC World Service.
I was not sure at the beginning if they were kidnapping me for political reasons, if they were kidnapping me for money. The whole situation was for me totally unclear.
Search for Lives Less Ordinary wherever you get your podcasts.